Adam.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In January this year, the investigative unit of the Boston Globe, known as the Spotlight Team, broke the story that the Archdiocese of Boston had quietly allowed John Gagan, a Catholic priest with a long history of sexually abusing children, to move from parish to parish, preying on his parishioners without a word of warning. And that was just the first story. In the months ahead came waves of front-page shockers that sent one of the most powerful institutions in the city into a national crisis. As the story mounted and ultimately found over 40 years of sex abuse involving thousands of children and young teenagers and hundreds of Roman Catholic priests involved, the secret was out, the church's unholy shame exposed, the faithful up in arms. In this hour, the reporters who broke the story of faith and betrayal tell the story of how they uncovered the darkest secret of the American Catholic Church. The Boston Globe investigation sparked calls for reform by lay Catholics seeking a greater voice and role in the church. The group Voice of the Faithful started in a church basement and has quickly grown into a national movement. Tomorrow, more than 4,000 members will gather in Boston for a national convention. Paul Beyer is a member of Voice of the Faithful and chairman of the national conference. Earlier, I asked him what kind of response he's seen to the Voice of the Faithful around the call around the country.
Tom, the response has been simply overwhelming. The Voice of the Faithful group started in early February in response to some of the revelations that came out in January. 6 months later, we have a membership of over 19,000 in 40 different states and 20 different countries. It's been truly a phenomenal grassroots, word-of-mouth, word-of-email type of environment.
So the lay Catholic in America is interested in this, and many are joining. What about the hierarchy of the Catholic Church in America? Is it responding? Does it want to see this kind of lay voice come forward?
Yeah, I think the hierarchy is trying to understand the lay voice. At first, I think they felt very threatened that we were trying to form a new church or breakaway church. And we've been in some dialogues with some of the church leaders here in Boston. Historically, the church has not had a very proactive relationship with the laity. The communication we're asking for is historic in that sense.
What are the goals of Voice of the Faithful?
We have three goals. First is to support the victims, the people who have been abused, both minors, male and female.
These are victims of sexual abuse by priests?
Correct. Second is to support the priest of integrity. There are many good priests that many of us know as Catholics who have done great work, have profound impacts in our lives, are tainted because of the scandal. We want to protect those. And our third goal is to shape structural change in the church, particularly around administrative areas like how we spend our money, how we allocate money between charities, and how we deal with felonies like child abuse.
How is the third goal going? Are you finding that you have enough to grab onto here to influence the structure of the Catholic Church and its operations?
Well, you know, one of the things that the scandal has caused is an awakening of the Catholic laity. Many of us have been kind of checkbook Catholics or Sunday Catholics. The scandal has forced us to, you know, really improve upon our education. A lot of us have PhDs in the secular world and kindergarten educations in the Catholic education. And many of the rights and obligations that we laity now are asking for were actually granted to the laity in a set of meetings called Vatican II in the early 60s.
Mm-hmm. But were never fully picked up on? Is that what you're saying?
Correct. Were never implemented. And in some sense, were, you know, kind of shelved and in that power vacuum, kind of taken back by the hierarchy. But the Vatican II documents actually are quite clear, and many places within canon law, which is the internal governance law of the church. So in that sense, Voice of the Faithful, we're not at all radical. We're really just kind of taking our place at the table, which had always been there from the beginning.
There's been such a furor this winter, spring, even into summer, over the reports of sexual abuse and the scandal around that. Do you have the sense that the momentum will be carried forward beyond this period of scandal as things die down? Is there a little less evident in the headlines? Are there enough Catholics concerned enough that real change will emerge?
I think that's a big question. We're trying the hardest to help that, but at the end of the day, it really is going to take, you know, a third to two-thirds of the mainstream Catholics stepping forward. One of the things that we are concerned about is the potentially a third sin here. If the first sin was the abuse by the priest and the second sin was a cover-up by the bishops, is there potentially a third sin here of omission as many Catholics turn the eye to this? And I think the response that we've seen already over the last 6 months is showing that this is not the case. We have every indication that this will continue to grow well past the media hype that's around the scandal right now.
Several thousand of your members are meeting in Boston this weekend. What's on the agenda?
We have three goals for our agenda that are for conference that begins tomorrow. First, we're gathering to pray together. It's an important part of the Catholic practice. Second, we're going to educate ourselves. We have a number of theologians from Notre Dame and Boston College who are coming and talking about the rights that the laity have to meet. There's been a lot of misinformation delivered by pastors and bishops telling different Catholics they're not allowed to meet in groups, and this is actually all incorrect. As part of the education process, we're releasing a statement that's signed by over 68 theologians in support of Voice of the Faithful. And the third thing we're doing is we're organizing. We'll be announcing the names and addresses of over 75 chapters around the United States of groups that have formed at the parish level to push and support the three goals we have.
If Voice of the Faithful is successful in rallying enough people to bring about real change in the Catholic Church in America, will the Catholic Church look different?
We sure hope so. I think one of the things that we believe we can help quite a bit is parish renewal. We really do have a lot of Catholics who are going in, they throw the money in, they spend the hour, and then they kind of go back to the secular world. I think in this world of tremendous technological advances and advances around genetics and everything else, we have a lot of questions we need to grapple with. So I think that's one thing you'll see is a much more vibrant discussion and a better educated laity. The second thing I think you'll see is a lot more reach-out programs for the youth. The sad reality is that many young people are not returning to the church. We've lost at least one, if not two, generations. And the only way that we're going to continue to have a vibrant church in the future is to reach out and cultivate younger people. And I think the third thing you're going to see is a revival and a support of good ministry. So pastors and priests who really are doing a good job are going to be celebrated a lot more. You know, it's almost like a best practices in how to tend to the particular congregation in the church.
Does this all add up to a revolution that you're seeking in Catholic Church practice?
Revolution may be too strong. I think certainly a significant turning of the tide. If you kind of jump up a level and think about the church from a 200-300-year perspective, Vatican II was a profoundly radical move in terms of modernizing a church, which was really kind of stuck back in the Middle Ages. So this is really a significant effort of connecting the dots and moving a church back to the vision that was laid out in Vatican II. In that sense, it's incredibly historic.
But for all that, Paul Beyer, you're up against, as you well know, centuries of habit and a church hierarchy with very deep beliefs about its own rights and place within the church. Are you confident that this change will take place?
We're certainly confident that the moral clarity on this scandal is quite clear. We're very confident that as Catholics become educated about what's really going on, and this is not a case of a few bad apples, but a case of a bad barrel where we really do have some problems in how we train and manage priests, that they will step forward. We'd never imagined 8 months ago that we'd have 10-plus grand juries around the country and a scandal in the church. We never imagined that the Russian Empire would fall or we'd see a balanced budget in the United States. So, you know, yes, it's a huge challenge, but I don't think it's insurmountable in these days.
Miracles can happen. Paul Beyer, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Paul Beyer is with the Voice of the Faithful and chairman of tomorrow's national convention in Boston. We're talking tonight about a newspaper and the powerful institution and taboos it challenged in uncovering the child sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church, a scandal cracked open by the Boston Globe and soon acknowledged across the country for all the world to read. What was your reaction as the truth finally tumbled out? Is this exactly what you want from a free press, or more than you can bear? Would the newspaper in your town be as brave? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With me in the studio tonight are two of the Boston Globe reporters who broke the priest abuse sex scandal open. Sasha Pfeiffer is a member of the Globe's Spotlight team, and Michael Paulson covers religion for the paper. They're co-authors, along with the rest of the investigative staff, of the new book, Betrayal, The Crisis in the Catholic Church. Good evening, Sasha Pfeiffer and Michael Paulson. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Sasha Pfeiffer, you have been with this Spotlight team, the investigative unit, for a long time. Take us back to the origins of this round of reporting and what laid the baseline for what was to become a firestorm across the country that caught up the whole nation and certainly all Catholics. Take us back to the key elements that began this journey toward the explosion.
Last spring, we had just finished a series on shoddy home construction. We were looking for a new project. At roughly the same time, Cardinal Bernard Law had acknowledged that before he assigned Father John Gagan to his final assignment at St. Julian Weston, he knew that Gagan had allegedly abused 7 kids. And that made big news, because while John Gagan had been in the news for a long time, suddenly the story was less about a priest who abused kids and more about church leaders who were aware of that abuse yet allowed him to remain in ministry. At also roughly the same time, the Globe had a new editor, Marty Baron. He came from Florida, where there are very open public access, public record laws. Mm-hmm. The Gagan court file had been under seal, court-ordered confidentiality seal, for about a year. Marty Baron said, why is it sealed and shouldn't we seek to unseal it? The Globe decided we would do that. Our lawyers went to court. It took probably about 3 months, and we ultimately got an order from Superior Court Judge Connie Sweeney, who ordered that the file be unsealed. It probably then took another 2 months to actually get the paperwork. In the interim, we set out to try to determine how many priests in the Boston Archdiocese had been accused of abuse, how many had been transferred, how much money had been paid out to alleged victims. So while we were waiting for this file to be unsealed, we began to establish what turned out to be a massive database that tracked about 20 years of movements of Boston Archdiocesan priests. We went through, it was a very tedious process, we went through 20 years of directories published by the Archdiocese itself, in which they list where each priest is year to year. If you look at some alleged abusers, you see a lot of assignments such as sick leave, health leave, awaiting assignment, lend lease. You see these sort of dubious administrative
red flags,
decisions.
Exactly.
Clergy personnel office. And we began to notice a large number of these. We compiled this database, not sure what we had. Later, after we began writing and calls began to pour in from victims, we realized it was an invaluable database. Almost inevitably, when we would get calls about, very credible calls about alleged abusers, those names are on our list. It was an amazing thing.
Michael Paulson, you know very well that this was not the first round of reporting on sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. There had been a case in 92. The Boston Globe had reported on Father Michael Porter very extensively. Whole books had been written about it. But something about the way it broke open this time led to the floodgates just finally opening. What was the difference?
You're right. This scandal had been percolating since the early 80s when it first broke in Louisiana. There had been a number of very dramatic cases, including the Porter case here in Massachusetts. The Gagan case was different, as Sasha said, in that it was the first case in which a newspaper was able to conclusively show, using the church's own documents, that bishops had been fully aware that priests had been abusing children and had left those priests on the job. And I think it was that awareness that bishops had failed to protect lay people that really infuriated the Catholic laity and caused this to explode into the scandal that we now know that it is.
But what turned it? Why didn't it explode in 1992? Why didn't it explode in the 80s? What was it that really pushed it right over the brink?
Yeah, again, I think it was that the Globe was able to obtain access to an incredible set of documents within the Archdiocese of Boston, which had carefully chronicled all of the allegations against Father Gagan, and this string of letters, some of which were just heart-wrenching, a letter from a mother of a victim of several victims who talked about her agony at having to come to the church to talk about the victimization of her children, and the bishops did nothing, and letters from Cardinal Law to Father Gagan congratulating him on his fine years of service, even as he was known to have molested numerous children over a period of decades.
Full disclosure, I was at the Globe when the earlier cases, when the Porter case was reported, but of course it didn't turn into anything like this turned into. And I've watched over the last months as this work was done and this thing exploded, just in awe at the work that was done there. I mean, to my mind, this is what newspapers are all about. But we're here tonight exploring what it was like to challenge such a powerful institution on something very much like its home turf. We're talking about cracking open the crisis in the Catholic Church with reporters of the Boston Globe who launched, well, what everyone knows about today. Is this what you want from a free press? Should anything, any institution, any person be beyond this kind of scrutiny? And as the lurid headlines poured out, were you always rooting for the reporters, or did you think they'd gone too far? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about cracking open the crisis in the Catholic Church with reporters of the Boston Globe who were very much at the heart of that whole effort. What do you think? Is this what you want from a free press? As the headlines poured out, were you always rooting for the reporters, or did you think they'd gone too far? Did you ever suspect anti-Catholic bias in the press onslaught? Do you now? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by two Boston Globe reporters, Sasha Pfeiffer, who was on the Spotlight team, the Globe's investigative unit that jumped on this story early and stayed on it long and stayed on it until it became a really, truly national, maybe global story, and Michael Paulson, religion reporter for the Boston Globe, who was also part of the group that broke this story. They've both contributed to a new book the Boston Globe has brought out called Betrayal. It's all about the story of how sexual abuse of children and teenagers was committed and covered up in the Catholic Church for decades before the explosion of news this year. I want to talk with you throughout this hour, but it's really the backstory, the journalistic story that we're interested in tonight. And I want to look at the Boston Globe's background. Here was a newspaper that had Yankee Brahmin Protestant founders, that a family that stayed with it in the paper and involved for more than a century. That it always had a very close relationship with the Irish Catholic community in Boston, kind of built the newspaper on the back of that relationship. And here, in the winter of 2001 and 2002, was lighting a fuse that promised to just blow that whole community, that Catholic community, wide open. It was obvious that there was going to be pain and agony, and that the paper was on a collision course with an extremely powerful local institution. Was that something that you talked about when you sat down as reporters, as editors, and looked at the story that you were beginning to dig into?
It was certainly something we were aware of. We were aware of the reputation the Globe had among some people as having an anti-Catholic bias. But, you know, we had an incredible story. We had discovered an outrageous thing had happened and was continuing to happen, and the documents, to a huge extent, spoke for themselves. We weren't sure what the public reaction would be after our first stories ran. We braced ourselves for a possible picket line. We found the opposite. It was incredible. I think that the calls of support surprised all of us. I think people who were glad to finally see it come out in the open, people who encouraged us to stay on it, not to sort of jump on the media bandwagon, and once the next big issue came up, to move on. So we found tremendous support. Certainly there were some people who have been angry, but I think the documents speak for themselves.
The documents required the Globe taking legal action to unlock them. Did you have a sense that the judge was going to rule in the Globe's favor? Was it a complete mystery until the ruling came down? Was there a conversation that you're aware of? Did you have a sense of the arguments that the Globe attorney was making before the court?
Sure. The Globe was arguing throughout that it was in the public interest that these documents be revealed. The Archdiocese of Boston fought this step after step. The Globe won an initial ruling. The Archdiocese appealed. But the Globe knew all along that these documents had the potential to illustrate knowledge by the hierarchy of Gagan's sins, and that as a result they were explosive.
Cardinal Law, Bernard Law in the Boston Archdiocese, of course, in the past had sharply criticized the Globe, saying that it was on a kind of witch hunt against the Catholic Church. You must have been prepared for that same kind of counterblow again, Sasha Pfeiffer.
We weren't sure what to expect, and I think that part of what fueled the story was Cardinal Law's reaction to our initial stories, which was to apologize repeatedly, to take steps to say he would correct the situation. So, again, I think the Church's very different reaction this time helped make the story what it is.
That they apologized, but yet there was resistance. Describe the resistance from the Church. How acute was it? How well targeted? Was it just a kind of public exchange or the exchange of letters? Or was it more, going for the juggler than that?
Well, I guess the Church has had a kind of mixed approach to this whole story. They resisted the release of the Gagan documents in court. since January, they've resisted the release of Cardinal Law's depositions of numerous documents. They've resisted access at various points in the legal process. Cardinal Law was repeatedly invited to talk with the Globe before we published our first stories on this scandal, and he declined. Cardinal Law has spoken to us rarely since the story broke. He has promised all along to remove from the ministry anyone who has ever abused a child, and he's had to correct himself repeatedly along the way, as it's turned out that he was mistaken and that there were still priests on the job who had molested children. The Archdiocese has talked about being more open and more forthcoming, and in some ways they have been. But on the legal front, they've continued to put obstacles in the way of the public seeing internal church documents.
When did you know, beyond getting the documents and reading them, and they are incredible, the letters, the agony, the pain there and pathos is a stunning thing, and a lot of that is in the back of the book, Betrayal. But when did you know that this was catching fire, that this was not only going to be a story in Boston, but a story that was going to roll right across the nation as it did?
I think that we sensed that the very morning that we ran our story and we came to work and the phones didn't stop ringing for weeks. I mean, we took hundreds and eventually thousands of calls, thousands of emails from victims who, it was an outpouring, and victims who, interestingly, for the first time, were willing to provide their names to us in many cases. In the past, it had been sort of a shameful thing. There was a sense that it was a stigma. People came, there were anonymous allegations. Now we had public allegations, often about, you know, from people across the country, about the same priests, people who would have no way to have known about each other, who were telling us the same stories. And the ripple effect was intense and fast and incredible.
The relationship, Michael Paulson, between the Globe and the attorneys who were representing victims of Catholic priests throughout this was one of lots of public speculation. I guess a simple question, what portion of the victim stories that you ultimately came up with came from attorneys? And what was the relationship, or is this perhaps is more Sasha Pfeiffer's question to answer? What was the relationship between the newspaper and these attorneys who had made a lot of money in pushing these cases with the Catholic Church in the past, who stood to make a lot of money in the future? Was this a partnership? Was it how would you describe the relationship between the paper and the attorneys?
Well, I think the vast number of victims we heard from came to us independently through phone calls. We ran a tip box. We ran a number that where people could call us live or leave a confidential message. You know, certainly we know most of the plaintiff's attorneys involved in this case. Many of them were eager to finally have their clients' stories told. These are lawyers who had been working behind the scenes for years and had been criticized for that, because certainly many of the lawyers who settled cases privately in the past were now being public, sometimes apologetic for having settled those cases. So, but still, I think for the most part, those callers came to us independently.
So overwhelmingly, would you say? Half and half?
I think more than half came.
A majority of the victim stories straight to you after the reporting began.
I would say that's fair, yes.
Well, that's a powerful draw. We're talking with Sasha Pfeiffer and Michael Paulson, two of the Boston Globe reporters who were at the heart of uncovering the scandal in the Catholic Church over priest abuse, sexual abuse of children. And what it says about a newspaper, about the American press, that a story like this can come out in the face of an institution as powerful as the Catholic Church. You can join the conversation as well. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Amy's on the line. Welcome, Amy. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I wanted to start by thanking the two reporters that you're interviewing for the work you've done. It's really, you know, I don't know if you realize that it's made a difference in the lives of people who are not Catholic and who were not abused by priests, but who were abused as children.
So you're saying that it shed a light that really went even beyond the Catholic community?
Oh, yeah. I've noticed that part of the story hasn't been covered, and I kind of wanted to suggest you might want to, that the whole, you know, the experience of childhood abuse, is, as I'm sure you know, is one of shame and secrecy. And to have the major newspaper in town talking about it every day has been very healthy for a lot of people who are not Catholic, but who have, you know, as I was, were abused as children.
And the other angle you're talking about, Amy, is to take the spotlight right on out to the larger community?
Well, I think that there's an impact on the climate in the city, and I think perhaps in the country now, in the sense that it's more possible that you might be believed should you bring this up in your family or in your community or wherever it happened, than it was, I think, previously. The whole issue of bringing it up and being dismissed and not being believed and told that couldn't have happened, that's pretty much the experience that the young people had with the Catholic Church, but that's also the experience that anybody who brings this up has. That's just how it is.
So yet another positive effect of getting it out and airing
it. It's very good for people's mental health is what I think mm-hmm. what I'm trying to say. You've done a good job. You've helped the therapists along.
There's nodding acknowledgement here, and we thank you for your call, Amy. This brings up a couple of interesting things. One, as the reports came into you and you reported them quickly and in volume, did the volume of victim calls continue to increase? Amy's saying it's made people more free to talk about these things, and did that spike up? And I guess another question that comes to mind is, throughout, there was a little back chatter here. Look, there is sexual abuse of children throughout American society. Why are you focusing on the Catholic Church? It's unfair.
Yeah, I think Amy brings up some really interesting points, and I'm so grateful to hear what she said because, of course, if our stories did help victims come forward and be believed, mm-hmm. and if it has led to protection of children, then we couldn't have asked for anything more than that. But I think, Tom, when you were asking earlier about what changed now, why the story was so explosive this year, I think one of the things that has changed in this country over the last couple decades is that we are more ready to talk openly about sexual abuse. We're more ready to talk openly about sexuality in general, but we're also ready to talk publicly about a scandal that makes us all uncomfortable.
Could you feel that readiness exploding even during the 6 months white heat of your reports?
Sure. I think we found, as Sasha was saying, victims more willing to attach their names to their stories, more willing to tell their stories in some detail and to go public. And I think we saw in the reaction, which at one point in history would have been disbelief, we now saw acceptance to a degree.
And Sasha Pfeiffer, what about this complaint that we heard in some quarters, especially early on, that sex abuse is everywhere? Why, you know, the percentage is perhaps not even higher in the Catholic Church. Why are you picking on the Catholic Church?
I'll jump in on this
okay.
Again. We don't think we're picking on the Catholic Church. We've taken clearly we've acknowledged that there is sex abuse in other aspects of society. There's sex abuse in families. There's sex abuse in schools. We've taken a look, though, at other religious denominations, and we've not found any that has a problem of sexual abuse of children to the degree that the Catholic Church has had. One of the problems with this whole area is that there have been very few statistical studies. We wish there were more we could fall back on. But we're quite confident that what happened in the Catholic Church over the last several decades was of a scale that was disproportionate and worthy of focus by a major newspaper.
And you sure did it. We're talking with Sasha Pfeiffer and Michael Paulson, two reporters at the Boston Globe. Neil is on the line. Welcome, Neil. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
My question relates to the perspective of from Cardinal Law's perspective. And he has come out, and some of the other people in the authority in the church have come out and said that they were trying to rehabilitate these priests, that they believed that the power of penance and the power of forgiveness allowed them to proceed in the direction that they chose to proceed. And I was wondering if, in your investigation, you came across information that would allow us to understand how that perspective could be used in the way that they did.
Well, I think it's true that the church perceived this within the language of religion, sin, reconciliation, forgiveness. I mean, I think it's very clear that the church didn't think this was a crime. And it's been a real seismic shift for the church to have to publicly acknowledge, yes, this was criminal. I mean, and we even find sort of among parishioners that it is that color makes it difficult for people to acknowledge that what happened was crime.
But there it is. Look at the statute books, and there's the crime. Bob's calling. Oh, Neil, thank you for your call. Bob's calling. Welcome, Bob. You're on the air.
Thank you. I had wanted to respond to your question about the bias issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I do not believe that I saw any bias against the Catholic Church by the media in this, and I think they're to be commended for that. I do think in general, however, the media tends to have an anti-church bias in general. But that's sort of a side note. I'd like to challenge the media, to challenge the Catholic Church, to not just put a Band-Aid on this, but to examine their own core doctrine, which has promoted this. I mean, this is obviously not one or two renegade priests. This is a whole bunch of priests all around the world, and especially in the United States, that are doing these monstrous things, and there's a core reason behind this. And it's not one or two bad apples, and it's not that the Catholic priesthood has attracted one or two bad apples. It's that the Catholic Church ignores the doctrine of the Bible that says that men should not be forbidden to marry. And, you know, denying the fact that God makes us sexual creatures, and for them to impose man's doctrine rather than look into the Bible, the Catholic Church has forced and put the situation there where, it, of course, this happened. You couldn't see another way around it.
Bob, I think we've got you, but you raise an interesting issue of how far a newspaper's job, responsibility, goes. And thank you for raising it. Michael Paulson, let me put it to you. At the Globe, does it now feel as though you've handed off to the laity, that you've done your work, and now it's the church's opportunity or problem to heal itself?
Well, of course, we and the Catholic laity play very different roles in society. Our job is to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
Our job was to expose what went wrong, and now we will be chronicling the efforts of lay people to make the church change. We will be continuing to tell the story as it unfolds, but we are not calling for change or creating change. I think the caller raises this interesting issue about celibacy, and I think it's important to point out, again, we have a paucity of real studies on this issue, but there are no studies that link celibacy to the abuse of children. We all know that the most frequent population of abusers are married heterosexual men who abuse their own children or stepchildren. It is true that the Catholic Church has a celibate priesthood, but it's also true that there are Protestant clergy who have abused children.
So it's clearly wider. But this issue of when you've done your work and when it's over, up to the laity or to the church itself to carry on, is a fascinating one. The Globe was so integral for a while there in driving the story. You can hear in Bob's call the sort of sense, well, can't you help take it on? Sasha Pfeiffer, is the investigative unit's work done when the scandal is exposed?
Well, this has been an unprecedented project in many ways for Spotlight. Typically, we spend several months researching a project, and then we produce a series that runs for 2 or 3 or 4 days and has several follow-up stories.
Mm-hmm.
This has gone on for almost a year now. And we do. I mean, we are discussing among ourselves at what point is it time for Spotlight to take on another project. We think there are still stories to write about the church. I mean, at some point, probably Michael will probably write about this for years, you know, probably for as long as he remains at the Globe. But we think there are still stories out there. Spotlight will focus on investigative stories. But it's, you know, it's, we're at a very delicate and fascinating point in this story, which is, you know, some readers felt that Dallas, the conference in Dallas, U.S. Catholic
could
conference
could be seen
officials,
as a culmination, I suppose.
Right. And I think some people, we got calls from people saying, well, aren't you done now? I mean, it's time to back off. And we disagree. We think that as long as there are good stories to write, we'll write them.
Sasha, how long have you been a newspaper reporter?
Since about 1994.
Have you ever been part of a story of anything like this scale or impact?
No. I think that it's been an unexpected and amazing ride for everyone involved.
Yeah, including the public, including the readers, and at this point, including most of the country. We're talking tonight about the process of cracking open the scandal in the Catholic Church with reporters of the Boston Globe, very instrumental in that in the early months of this year before papers all over the country took up the call. What do you think? Is this what you want from a free press? Should anything, any institution, any person be beyond this kind of scrutiny? Was this just a newspaper doing its job, or was this something extraordinary? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the journalistic work of cracking open the crisis in the Catholic Church with reporters of the Boston Globe, the newspaper that was at the heart of opening up the scandal that has now swept in most of the Catholic Church and every thinking, reading person around the country in the trauma that followed and the self-examination that continues in the Catholic Church. What do you think? As the lurid headlines poured out, were you always rooting for the reporters, or did you think they'd gone too far? And do you assume that the newspaper in your town is brave enough to take on the powers that be, a power as large as the Catholic Church in Boston? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight are two Boston Globe reporters, Sasha Pfeiffer and Michael Paulson. Sasha Pfeiffer, I wanted to ask you, when you first picked up those documents, when the judge said, you can look, you can see, you can examine them, And I don't know, how did it happen? Did you go to the courthouse and make photocopies? Did you bring back carts and boxes and bundles? And when you first opened up those bundles and began to look into the letters and into the memos, what was your response? What did you think you had?
We sifted through probably 10,000 pages of boxes of documents, and we were looking at psychiatric records, medical records, personnel records, that made clear that over the course of more than three decades, Gagin had had a long history of allegedly molesting children, that despite that, he was transferred from parish to parish. There were very sympathetic letters to and about Gagin from church leaders, letters that were signed, you know, God bless you, Jack, references to accusations against him having been unfortunate and traumatic for Gagin, not for the alleged victims.
And was there also evidence already there that this went beyond John Gagin?
Yes, in that the sort of the fingerprints, the signatures of numerous bishops and cardinals were in these papers. What was interesting to me is that investigative work often sounds glamorous but can be very tedious. There are very few smoking gun documents. But this was extraordinary in that what these documents were spelling out were the kind of thing you hope to find but often don't when you're doing this kind of project.
Would this have happened if it hadn't – would this whole thing have come out if it hadn't been for those documents, if it hadn't been for the Globe challenge to the lock and key that they had been under legally?
We don't think so. We think that that's what made the story different. That's why – I mean, certainly allegations against priests had been in the news for years, but this made it clear. This moved the shift of the story from a story about priests who abused children to about church leaders who protected priests who abused children.
And was there something about having a new editor in the house with a new angle on the community and perhaps a different style that made this happen? Had the Globe challenged lots of deals, agreements had been made in the past in the courts and outside the courts between the church and victims of sex abuse. Had the Globe challenged the lock and key before? Had it gone after closed documents in the past?
I think it always helps to have a fresh set of eyes on a story. The new editor at the Globe, Marty Baron, had the good fortune to start at the Globe at the same time that this really key document was filed in court by Cardinal Law, acknowledging that before he had made Gagin the parochial vicar in Weston, he had known that there were accusations against him. And it was the news coverage of that court filing that referred to sealed documents. And Mr. Baron started and began to question why those documents were sealed and insisted that we go forward.
We've got a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. Let's turn to them. Jim is on the line. Welcome, Jim. You're on the air.
Thank you. I have a friend who was abused some years back, and he's not particularly interested in reliving it at this point. Mm-hmm. But enough information is out that he's been hounded by people, including by the press. He changed his phone number to something unlisted, and reporters called him on that number as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'll acknowledge this is a very important story, but my question for your guests is, where are the limits with something like this, where you have victims who may not wish to relive all of this?
We knew that we were dealing with very fragile and very vulnerable people, and we tried, and I believe we did, treat people very delicately and respectfully. I don't think we hounded people. I mean, I think that maybe after this came public and a lot of other media outlets jumped on this and victims' names went forward, sometimes those victims found that when they woke up in the morning, the camera crews were on their front steps. But I think that we were fully aware that these were life-altering incidents for victims, and we tried to take the utmost care as we talked with people.
But you were on a huge story, and the nostrils must have been flaring at the scent of everything that was out there. I mean, it must have been hard sometimes not to push for that extra insight from a victim, from that extra admission, that extra even degree of emotion.
Well, I think we had a sense as reporters in general of how far we could go with a person who we were interviewing, how we could sense what that person did and didn't want to talk about, and we pushed a little, but we tried to do it respectfully, and if we felt that they didn't want to talk about something, we would respect that.
Ultimately, there was such an abundance that you didn't have to push in each individual person, I suppose. Jim, thanks for that call. Matt's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Thanks. I'm a electronic media student at Wartburg College.
Okay.
In Waverly, Iowa. And we kind of have just a playful rivalry going between the EM students and the print students.
It sounds like you're in the press room right now, Matt.
I'm actually driving.
Okay.
And we often say that print is dead, but do you feel that this is maybe a niche that print could fit into, exposing these large stories like this in a more 24-hour news-dominated media?
Matt, thanks for your question and your call. Print was dead. That was last decade. Now AOL is the one in trouble, I guess. But the question stands. In an era when we've got all kinds of internet information flying around, Michael Paulson, are you reinvigorated? Are you heartened by what you've seen in the work of your own paper in this case sort of maybe showing the way for what a serious long-term investigation in journalism can produce?
Sure. I think this story has been tremendously heartening for all of us. It has illustrated the good that journalists can do. I think we, those of us who choose to work at papers like the Boston Globe, never thought print was dead. And I think that this story touches on two subjects, religion and investigative reporting, that newspapers are particularly strong at and broadcast media are particularly weak at. But it is interesting, one of the story did take place in 2002, and the internet has played a huge role in helping us transmit our stories. We've had email from all across the country and all across the world. We have thousands, perhaps millions of people logging onto the Globe's website every day to read these stories. And the reach of this story and the impact of this story has really been amplified by the internet phenomenon.
So the internet may not have produced it, but it has helped the community of response that came to the first story.
And it has helped us report, because it has led sources to us. It has led victims to us. It has led priests to us who want to talk to us.
Mm-hmm. Matt, thanks for your call. Sarah's on the line. Welcome, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to express my appreciation to everybody, because many, many years ago in New Jersey, I was a victim of a priest.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also, so many of the things that have come out have been about boys. It's been gratifying, and I know that's a strange word to hear, that we're now starting to hear about girls, but I just want to commend these people for all the work they've done and for all the digging they've done.
Duly acknowledged, Sarah, and thank you for your call. Sasha, Michael, I wonder if in the whole course of this incredible year that you've been in the midst of, was there ever a dark night of doubt when you thought, oh, my gosh, we've taken this too far, we've gone in the wrong direction, we've pushed someone too far, there were moments in this where there was pushback, when the church said, hey, cut it out, when lay Catholics for a while, in not insignificant numbers, were saying, come on, this is Catholic bashing, give it a rest. Was there ever a time when you felt doubt?
I think the answer to that is a very emphatic no. I think that the wrong that had taken place was so clear and so clearly spelled out in the documents that we were confident from beginning to end.
Michael?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would say the Globe has had a large group of people working on this story, and so we've had a lot of internal discussion about what kinds of stories we want to run and how those stories are presented. We've been very careful to stay within the confines of what we know to be true, and we're quite comfortable with what we've published.
Well, there it is. What a session. This is a stretch of months you'll probably talk to journalism school students about, you'll probably tell your children about one day if you haven't already, and that have obviously changed the lives of tens of thousands and ultimately in the Catholic community, millions of people. It's got to be a good feeling.
It is. You know, one thing we did talk about was that we wanted to make sure we wouldn't be open to charges that we had somehow sensationalized or been unnecessarily graphic. But we also wanted to make sure that molest and abuse never became generic terms, that people understood that what happened skillfully, and there was a great deal of manipulation, that relationships began that had an emotional component that became physical. So because this is all about the victims, and I think that we had many discussions about how we get that across while still taking a very serious approach to what we were doing.
Sasha Pfeiffer, Michael Paulson, and all the rest of your team in the Boston Globe, hats off, job well done, and thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Sasha Pfeiffer and Michael Paulson are reporters with the Boston Globe Spotlight team that uncovered the child sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on forums. In a moment, remembering the commandment of the commander of the Tuskegee Airmen. This is On Point. earlier this week, America's first black Air Force general was laid to rest at Arlington National Cemetery. Benjamin Davis commanded the Tuskegee Airmen, a unit of African-American soldiers who served in Europe and North Africa during World War II, when the armed forces were still segregated. Their service helped convince President Truman to integrate the military after the war. In this radio diary, Colonel Charles McGee, a Tuskegee Airman, reflects on the life of Benjamin Davis and the legacy of the airmen he led.
Colonel Davis, from the time he was a young person, had wanted to fly and had been denied that opportunity when he completed West Point in 1936. So he was quite focused and very determined. We young officers thought he was very stern and rigid, but he was that way for a purpose, not only out of his military training, but on his focus and determination to be a pilot and be a worthy pilot. And he instilled all of us with that same goal, that we focus on the mission and carry it out to the best of our abilities. We were fighting for our country as American soldiers, but we were also fighting the denial of equal opportunity that had taken place up until this opportunity came about. For instance, even though we were over fighting overseas, the effort to take segregation overseas, we were not using the rest camp on the Isle of Capri like white Americans were. We had to have our own rest camp. In fact, our whole operation there, except for a couple of periods that the 99th was attached to white groups, was a completely separate operation, a complete operation. But we didn't let that deter us from using our training to carry out the missions assigned, and the squadron was putting just as many bombs on target and as accurate, in some cases, maybe more accurate than other units. Subsequently, in looking at our experience and what was accomplished, the Air Force, when they became a separate service in 1946, realized that they needed to use people based on their skill, not their color, and the effort to try to maintain a separate base, there just wasn't enough money to do it on an equal basis, and the idea and the myth that blacks couldn't work with whites or couldn't lead whites turned out to be false. So President Harry Truman in 1948 issued an executive order mandating that all of the services should take steps to integrate, because it was more efficient. It was the use of all Americans rather than denying some or trying to use them only in the service role, giving each an opportunity to use their talents to the fullest. Our fight was one to perform and grade us on our performance and our merit rather than our color or happenstance of birth. Fortunately, we can say now we think there was a bit of victory in both.
Colonel Charles E. McGee flew combat missions under General Benjamin Davis's command and is president of Tuskegee Airmen, Inc. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth, Darren Manoogian, and Laura Tanguso. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.